Architect Rem Koolhaas once said that skyscrapers represent the wide open spaces of a man-made Wild West, a frontier in the sky. Well, today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about the wonder of skyscrapers, why and how we build them, and what has to be done to keep them standing. And joining me now are Carol Willis, an architectural historian, the founder and director of the Skyscraper Museum here in New York City, and William F. Baker, the partner in charge of structural and civil engineering for the Chicago and London offices of Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill. He's currently the structural engineer for what will soon be the tallest man-made structure ever, the Burj Dubai. I'm very pleased to welcome you both to the show. Hello.
My pleasure to be here.
Bill Baker, so do you qualify as a skyscraper frontiersman by Rem Koolhaas's definition?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, we do have a lot of fun doing these things and trying to create these things. But I think of skyscrapers more as like their dreams kind of rendered in steel and concrete.
So it's not just a matter of going where no one has ever gone before?
Well, it is exciting, but one goes there cautiously, let me say that.
Can you tell us just a bit about the building before we talk about skyscrapers in general? It's, as far as I understand it, its final height is still a secret, but it's going to be something like two times the height of the Empire State Building?
Yeah, that's approximately correct. It's still a secret. The client wants to keep the mystery going for a while yet. He said he might reveal it this summer. We'll have to see.
And how does he plan to fill this building?
Well, it's a residential building. It's kind of interesting. If you said skyscrapers stopped at, like, say, around 1980, you would have said they're built in North America, they're structural steel, and they're office buildings. Okay? But this building is certainly not. It's in the Middle East. It's made of concrete, not steel. And it's mainly a residential building. It's at the bottom, it's an Armani Hotel. And then you have high-class or very expensive residential units going up. And the very top are a few boutique office floors. But it's mainly a residential tower.
And then there is a high spire that brings it to its full height?
Yes. Yes, quite correct.
And that it's almost transparent, isn't it?
No, but it does taper dramatically as you go up. It's a very very slender at the top, very filigree-like. And in fact, Carol had me give a lecture once at her museum on Frank Lloyd Wright's Mile High Tower, and it's somewhat like that in the way that it tapers up to a very fine pinnacle at the top.
Now, Carol, didn't Frank Lloyd Wright once suggest that we build 2-mile-high buildings in Central Park and then knock down the rest of New York City and make them into one-story family residences?
Well, Frank Lloyd Wright was a genius who said many outrageous things during his long life of 90 years. He wasn't really a skyscraper builder, although the museum did have an exhibition that was curated by Hilary Ballin of Wright's towers, and he built only really one in his lifetime, but he dreamed of very tall ones, and of course his ego was a driving force in thinking big.
Well, how do we define the term skyscraper? Is it just a tall building, or are there other factors?
Well, I think the term itself originated even before tall buildings, and it was always used to describe objects or people or ship masts, which were extremely tall and slender and had a kind of silhouette against the sky that made them skyscrape. And the term became applied to office buildings, tall office buildings, and also hotels when the urbanization process, especially in New York and also in Chicago, in the last decades of the 19th century, began to produce ever taller buildings on more valuable land with new technologies that made it possible to crowd together and to make cities like New York.
New technologies like elevators. Doesn't Chicago claim to have built the first one, the home insurance building?
Well, Chicago does claim that. There's much controversy whether New York or Chicago is the birthplace of the skyscraper, and of course that depends very much on what definition you use for the term. Chicago did invent something, William LeBaron Jenney, the Chicago frame, a cage of steel construction that allowed buildings to rise taller than the heights of masonry, which pretty much maxes out at 14 stories. Chicago has the Monadnock Building, which is a masonry structure that's that tall. So facilitating technologies of the elevator, which was invented back in the 1850s but isn't really introduced in buildings until the 1870s, and steel cage construction or metal frame construction came together in the 1870s and after. But there are a lot of other reasons why New York came late to that technology. But New York had taller buildings than Chicago during this time. So, well,
and Chicago also at one point put limits on building heights.
They certainly did. In 1892-93, the city fathers decided that there were already quite enough tall buildings. There was a skyscrapers always follow in their growth the economic cycle. And then when the economic cycle is excited, tall buildings rise up and money is very liquid and there's a lot of lending for taller buildings. So when there was overbuilding in Chicago as a result of the Columbian Exposition, there was too much space. And so the idea was to tamp down the market and to limit height.
Well, I've been to Chicago recently, and obviously they've repealed that law.
They did after World War II.
Bill Baker, among your colleagues, is there one building that stands out as the quintessential skyscraper or the most beautiful or elegant one? I know New Yorkers pretty much all vote for the Chrysler Building.
Well, actually, I would take the Hancock, John Hancock here in Chicago as a symbol of Chicago. You know, it's the one that actually, if you look on the quarter, you know how every state has a quarter. If you look on the Illinois quarter, you see two images. One is Abraham Lincoln, the other is the John Hancock. It's kind of so. It's pretty much the symbol, and it's not Sears, even though Sears is taller.
But so you think that's the most beautiful skyscraper in the world right now, at least before the one that you build?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's got this. This texture, it's almost like something, an object you feel like you want to reach up and touch, the way the structure is expressed, and it's got this almost tactile sense in a visual. As you see it, you just wish you could reach up there and touch it. And the way it tapers and draws your eye upward, I think it's very good.
Now, Carol, there have been a number of different stages for the skyscrapers' development. The first, obviously, was when they were invented. But can you tell us about the others, post-World War I period, then the Depression and World War II and the more recent developments?
Mm-hmm. Well, sure. Well, taking New York really as the model of the different eras, which, again, coincide with cycles of investment, the late 19th century in New York spawned a whole series of towers and an inimitable skyline, the tallest of which sort of ended this first phase. And they were the world's tallest buildings, since that's a theme that we always pursue with skyscrapers. There were the Singer Building, the Metropolitan Life Building, which still stands, and the Woolworth Building in 1913, which was 792 feet tall, so more than twice as tall as any building at the turn of the century. So that those buildings were allowed to be built up straight up into the sky, unlike in Chicago, where the height limits were already in place. As tall as the architects and engineers could make them, but moderated by the economics of elevator construction and a whole series of economics that make it more expensive to build taller buildings than relatively short ones. So that era, which I call the laissez-faire era, because you could build absolutely anything that you wanted to, until 1916, ended with it ended when zoning was introduced in New York. And the 1916 zoning law was incredibly important to shape the skyline of New York through its great period of growth in the 1920s, finishing in the early 1930s before the Depression comes in. And
Was that because it was a fear that we would just have these canyons of tall buildings?
The zoning law was designed to protect light and air on the street, also to protect land values and the economics and the shade that befell many older buildings when buildings went up with unmoderated. So, but that setback, the wedding cake form or the stepped ziggurat that's so characteristic of the Chrysler Building, the Empire State Building, but more particularly all of the speculative office buildings and lofts that were built in the Garment District, that sort of cliffs and mountains kind of skyline with the pinnacle towers really is the sort of black and white Art Deco modern city that lasts until World War II, when after World War II, the new technologies of higher strength steel, of welded frames instead of older riveted frames, of glass technologies, the curtain wall, produced this new international style we think of as the glass box, like Lieberhaus or Seagram Building.
And Lieberhaus is a Skidmore, Owings & Merrill building, which, of course, is one of your buildings, Bill. Now we have the fourth generation, these global skyscrapers like Burj Dubai. Mm-hmm. Carol was talking about the earlier phase. She said they were being built as tall as the architects or the engineers could make them. Well, what does that mean today? In the simplest terms, why don't skyscrapers fall down when they get really, really tall?
Well, part of it is you have to have you have to be able to say spread your feet. You know, if you're standing upright and your feet are close together, you're not very stable. Someone can easily push you over. And the way you counteract that is you spread your feet out and you get much more stable. And this is kind of interesting why there's so many tall buildings in Chicago, say, compared to New York, because New York is really the city of skyscrapers in my mind. The only one that even has more so is, I say, Hong Kong. But in New York, there's a lot of tall buildings, but not very many super tall. And the reason for that is the city blocks in New York are only 200 foot wide. And as you march up the avenues, you go through all these, you know, all these streets, they're all 200 foot wide with a 60 foot street. So you could only put a building of certain height on that side of property. And then when you come to Chicago, the city blocks are around 330 foot, okay? And so in that extra space, you're able to put a taller tower, which is why if you look at the five tallest buildings in the United States, four of them are in Chicago, and only the Empire State is in New York. Now, what's changed since then is we've come up with a new technology, and it's the use of concrete and wind engineering. We've been able to do much, much taller.
You're not doing a steel skeleton as we were doing for so long?
No. We're either using all concrete or concrete and steel together. And there's several reasons for that. One is concrete, is even though it's much bulkier, is much stiffer than steel. And so if you have a smaller site, okay, you can do it in concrete where you couldn't do it in steel. We had a proposal once it was in the MoMA show a few years ago about skyscrapers, that was a 2,000-foot tower that was on a one-acre site. It would easily have fit on a New York City block. It's using the massiveness of the concrete to help resist these huge wind forces, because that's what controls tall buildings. It is when the wind blows past a building, as it goes past, it makes little swirls on both sides. We call these vortices. And it makes the building rock from side to side.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about the sway of buildings mm-hmm. like the Empire State Building. Can you do that with these big concrete buildings?
Yeah, you can resist it quite a bit more. And one of the things we've done, like on the Burj, is and Burj is Arabic for tower, okay? So it's basically Tower Dubai. But anyway, on Burj Dubai, what we do is we keep changing the shape of the building so that as this wind goes by and creates these pulses against the building, they don't happen at the same rate. They get very disorganized, so that you don't get because they don't get organized, you don't get these huge forces on the building, and you can go much, much taller with kind of essentially normal technology.
What about the simple stuff like elevators? I've read that the observatory elevators will travel 18 meters a second. That's 40 miles per hour.
Right.
How can people go that fast? What happens? I mean, I've never traveled that fast up, have I, other than in an airplane?
I truly think that that's going to be the limit on the height of skyscrapers, is going to be the comfort of your inner ear as you go high in a tall building. And if I go to the top of Sears or the Hancock, and if I have a head cold, I feel it, okay? And it's actually kind of interesting. You can take people up in elevators relatively fast, but you have to bring them down more slowly because their inner ear can't adjust to the air pressure as quickly when it's becoming pressurized versus depressurized.
So we could build buildings as tall as we'd like to, but then we'd have to find ways for people to actually get up to the top?
Yeah, I think that's it. And I was speculating the other day, is, you know, let's say you did a mile or 2 mile tall tower. Structurally, we could figure out how to do that. But the pressure difference, I mean, it's like if you were, say, we were a mile tall, that'd be like having your ground floor at sea level and your penthouse is in Denver.
Well, I would wonder about somebody who lived on the 150th floor of a building, especially if there was a power failure. I wouldn't want to have to climb all those stairs.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's changed a lot since post 9/11 is we put like what we call refuge floors. So as you come down, we actually have areas where one can rest and, you know, kind of get their energy back before they start going down. But certainly going down towers is much easier than going up.
Now, Carol, after 9/11, and we'll get into 9/11 in a few moments when we start taking calls. After 9/11, we had the president of Skidmore, Owings & Merrill here, among others. And she said that she didn't think that buildings would go above 50 stories in the near future because the era of the skyscraper was kind of over, and the World Trade Center was just another reason for it. But also, people were getting tired of all of the big egos that were being expressed by these tall buildings. But what's happened instead is they're going taller and taller. What do you think changed all of that?
Well, in New York, it's a somewhat different situation. In the U.S., generally somewhat different than it is in the other parts of the world that are sprouting skyscrapers in boom economies or trying to compete on the global stage. So it's worth noting that the difference between engineering height, which is unlimited, is a very different thing than the economic height of buildings. And in New York, we build always to the economic height, as they do everywhere, because skyscrapers are businesses, they're investments, they're commercial architecture. That's the category that they belong in. So they have to make money. They're also cultural constructs. And in New York, especially just before 9/11, we had a real animus against towers. People would come out and with black umbrellas in order to imitate the shadow that would fall on Central Park if a tower was built at the corner of Columbus Circle. There was the value of street life in small scale, which is held very close. There's preservation. So, and New York, in fact, limits towers by a formula from the 1961 zoning law called FAR that says you can only multiply the size of your lot so many times over. So it really is, as Bill was saying, virtually impossible to build a really tall tower in New York.
There was another reason. Most people hated the look of the World Trade Center until the towers were destroyed, and now there's a lot of nostalgia for them. But they were considered really ugly buildings. Well, let's take a little break, and when we come back, we'll take some calls and we'll talk about the World Trade Center, because we've been talking about Bill Baker as a structural engineer and the man who is now building the tallest building in the world, although I understand there may even be one that beats it in in Dubai, but that's a whole other matter. But he was also in charge of he was one of the lead investigators of the FEMA assessment of the World Trade Center collapse, and we're getting lots of calls from people who have been arguing that the fall of the towers is impossible. There must have been some other reasons, and well, I hope you'll address that, Bill. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Our phone number is 212-433-9692. And we're back with Carol Willis, who is an architectural historian, the founder of and director of the Skyscraper Museum here in New York City, and also the author of Form Follows Finance, Skyscrapers and Skylines in New York and Chicago. Also with us is William F. Baker, the partner in charge of structural and civil engineering for the Chicago and London offices of Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill. He served as one of the lead investigators of the FEMA assessment of the World Trade Center collapse. And we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. Before we get to those calls, Bill, could you just address the whole issue of whether the World Trade Center towers could have fallen the way they did without some help and without some, I think some people have suggested, without dynamite being placed at the joints?
I have absolutely no doubt that the collapse was caused by the airplane impacts and the ensuing fires. And what people need to understand is when those towers were hit by these airplanes, there was a huge amount of debris flying through the building. And as it did, it probably knocked off a tremendous amount of fireproofing. And then you had all the jet fuel. Now, the jet fuel probably burned out in a very few minutes, but it was like doing a barbecue and you use like a starter fluid. And so it immediately set the entire floors on fire. So you have fairly hot fires, mainly a contents fire, but burning next to steel, which is not fireproof. So the airplanes is the reasons the building came down. There is no other reason.
What about another aspect of building the World Trade Center towers? I gather that lots of people died, 60 people or so died in their construction. Is that typical? And should we assume that people will die in the construction of really tall buildings?
Construction is a dangerous business, and people do die. It's not necessary, it can, and it's much less than it used to be. I mean, When I first started, they would say you might lose, might be one person per million square foot, which is kind of a scary thought. But there's no reason that makes skyscrapers more dangerous than other construction. I think that the injuries one sees in skyscraper construction is probably typical with all construction. Construction is a dangerous business. You're walking around buildings which are not complete. There's openings, and they need to be properly marked, and there's people working above you who may drop things, and things may drop. So it's a dangerous business, but I don't think skyscrapers are particularly more dangerous than other construction.
Actually, the number 60 is way too high for the World Trade Center. I don't know the exact number, but no steel workers were killed or died on the site. And it's partly because of that sort of jail-like frame of the tube construction. No one fell on the site.
Well, I've seen mm-hmm. Lewis Hines photographs of the construction of the Empire State Building, and they give me a sense of vertigo just looking at the pictures.
In fact, the Skyscraper Museum has a book and exhibition, Building the Empire State. There are construction views, and they're on our website as well, over 500 of them. Only 5 construction workers and no iron workers were killed on that site.
Before we get to the calls, we have a comment on our WNYC comment line. This listener writes in, I believe the tallest building in Europe is Tour Montparnasse at about 55 floors. Is that true? And why haven't the Europeans entered the race for the tallest building? Is there a difference in architectural thinking in Europe? Bill, you're with the London office of Skidmore, Owings & Merrill.
I think the tallest building in Europe is either it's either in Frankfurt, the Helmut Jahn project, the
Commerzbank,
Messeturm. I think it's Messeturm, or
Commerzbank,
It could be the one at Canary Wharf by Cesare Pelli. But the Europeans really haven't gotten into it into the race as much. London recently is starting to sprout some pretty good tall towers around 1,000 feet, which is not going to be the world record, but quite tall, quite respectable. And it's kind of a late addition. When one thinks, you know, that the Eiffel Tower was the world's tallest building for quite a while, and certainly is the marker of Paris, that they haven't. But I'd say it's more cultural than anything.
Let's take some calls. Susan from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, Leonard, hi. This is Susan Allen. Just one issue I'd like to bring up, and I wonder what the thinking is out there with some of the architects today, is the number of bird kills that with tall buildings with skyscrapers. And information has come out in the last few years from this professor at Muhlenberg College, from Daniel Clem, that up to it's a billion birds a year collide with tall buildings. And I know New York City Audubon is working on this with bird-safe glass. And
I gather that the Freedom Tower has tried to work out something that would prevent that sort of thing from happening. Do you want to address it first, Carol?
I know there are many people who are very concerned about this issue. There are measures that are taken with special kinds of reflective glass, or many people want the lights of the city dimmed during migratory periods so that the birds are not attracted to the light and fly accidentally into the buildings. I think it's a difficult balance between the economy of the city, the life of the millions of people who love to look at the skyline of New York at night, and the idea of silencing and dimming the city for long periods of time.
It is an interesting problem. Here in Chicago, they actually, there's that white light at the top of Hancock. They actually turn it off during migratory season because it attracts the birds. They tend to fly around the building all night. In fact, apparently you can pick up, when the migrations are happening, you can pick it up on Doppler radar, and you can, like, see them, taking off in Kentucky or something, heading for Chicago. And they'll actually do, the tall buildings will try to turn off more lights during the migratory season.
Now, you remind me of the presentation of skyscrapers in Chicago. Chicago seems to be much prouder of its buildings, and they often have these spotlights on them. Perhaps it's because New York sticks all of its buildings together, chock-a-block, and we don't have those alleys separating the buildings. But also, you get the feeling that Chicago really does see the architecture and its public art as being a major part of the presentation of the city, and New York just kind of takes them for granted.
Well, certainly Chicago embraces skyscrapers. this building I talked about earlier, the 7 South Dearborn Tower that we proposed, you know, I remember when we presented to the city council, there was like, we had one comment from the public, and they said, why aren't you doing more of this? And then this new proposal from Calatrava for this very tall spiral building here in the city, everyone's embraced it. You know, Chicago just loves tall buildings.
There's a building that's been proposed where every floor turns once an hour.
Yes.
That strikes me as really odd, but I guess we're also talking about novelties here, aren't we?
Yeah, there is a lot of flash going on out there. It is. I love tall buildings, and I think there's a lot of good reasons and stuff. But when I go to like Shanghai or Dubai or some of these things, there's a lot of buildings that are shouting, "Look at me!" And unlike New York or Chicago, which grew up over time, where you had this context and you have background buildings and foreground buildings, and there's a relationship and a consistency of the art and architecture, which makes it very nice. These other cities are cacophonies of buildings more than.
Oh, you mean Donald Trump doesn't live in New York and doesn't put his name really big on those tall buildings? We go to Brad from, to Steve in Brooklyn. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Alan. I wanted to ask about one of the other reasons why the people were talking about not putting up taller buildings in New York, like the World Trade Center, was because the higher you go, you tend to lose more and more usable space. Now, you know, the World Trade Center had the those columns in the middle that were supporting it. I wanted to ask, is that still the case with these newer designs and the concrete that the guest was talking about?
One loses space to elevator shafts, which is the principal problem with tall buildings. You can't rent the space that's empty for the vertical circulation. Bill can talk about elevator technology, but there's double decking, but especially sky lobbies. And, of course, residential buildings don't require the same kind of traffic flow and rush hours that office buildings necessitate in terms of moving people around.
And I would assume that in a really tall building, if I wanted to have my own little space there, I'd be happy that I was the only tenant on the floor.
If you were a sheikh, yes.
and that's basically how the Burj is. You get up at the very top. These are one floor palaces in the sky, if you will. And it is it is true that you lose. It's more difficult to go taller, but the value also goes up.
Now, go ahead.
On the Burj Dubai, they sold all levels from level 19 to 108 in 3 nights. So they had essentially an invited auction, if you will.
We talked about the technology that involved having elevators go up now double-decker. But what about water, and can you do it really quickly? How do you get water to go all the way up to the 150th floor?
Well, you actually have to make it into like four 40-story buildings. That's how you have to. Because if you have a water pipe that goes from the very top to the very bottom, the pressures are huge, unbelievably high. And so what you have to do is you bring it up, say, 40 stories, and then you put it in a tank and then move it up again, or else your pressures. And the same thing for the wastewater coming down. If you had a pipe from top to bottom and it filled up, you could have some problems.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for being with us, and also announce that there'll be a symposium on Francis H. Kimball and the early New York skyscraper at the Skyscraper Museum this Saturday from 1 to 4. That's at 536 LaGuardia Place.
Saturday the 28th of April.
Isn't that soon? I think it is. Carol Willis, 2 weeks or whatever. Carol Willis has been here, and Bill Baker. We've been talking about skyscrapers on Please Explain. Thank you both so much. On Monday's show, one of the key researchers into mirror neurons and their role in the development of personality. Also, Julia Alvarez's latest novel, plus bass player Christian McBride celebrates the 85th birthday of the late Charles Mingus. And Sari Nusseibeh talks about advocating a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as the PLO's chief representative in Jerusalem from 2001 to 2002. By the way, if you missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenda Farrell, and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Bridget Bergen, Samantha Morgenstern, and Barbara Kahn. Alex Goldmark was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you on Monday.